representatives of the Libyan people, though they didn't offer full recognition. Tens of thousands of anti-government demonstrators have marched in cities across Yemen after Friday prayers, demanding the removal of President Ali Abdullah Saleh. At least six people were wounded when security forces fired at protesters in the southern port city of Aden. The United Nations Refugee Agency says close to 500,000 people have fled the fighting in Ivory Coast. A spokesman for the UNHCR told the BBC there were bodies lying on the streets in parts of the main city Abidjan, some being eaten by dogs. Fighting in the city between supporters of the recognised president Alassane Ouattara and the former leader Laurent Gbagbo has continued. The Spanish government has confirmed that four people arrested in northern France include alleged senior members of the armed Basque separatist group ETA. One of those held is the suspected ETA military chief Alejandro Zabarán Arriola, while another is the alleged logistics chief. And that's the BBC News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Tim Franks. The latest from Japanese police is that between 200 and 300 bodies have been found in a beachside suburb of Sendai following the huge earthquake that struck in the late afternoon local time. Television pictures showed the tsunami in full spate, neat suburbs and farmland being submerged by an angry, boiling black tide. From a camera aboard a helicopter came the strange sight of boats, houses, homes and cars surging across the landscape. Off to one side of the shot, there appeared the last frantic vestige of normality as a truck tried to speed away from the onrushing wall of chaos. A television crew was filming in Yokohama City, about 300 kilometres away, as the quake struck Japan. A reporter is speaking to camera. Then the cameraman shouts for people to get away from the buildings as masonry falls. The shout going up there of get away, get away, get away from the building. These witnesses in Yokohama City were shocked at the earthquake.
I've never experienced such shaking before. I couldn't stand up. I've never experienced such an earthquake before.
I have a feeling that something will happen around the world. It is really frightening. I'm almost 70 years old and this is the first time I've experienced this.
The Japanese Prime Minister Naoto Kan appeared on television to say that disaster operations were underway.
We have created an office to deal with the disaster, maintain the safety of everyone, and will look to reduce the amount of damage to the smallest possible amount.
And Elizabeth Beers from the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Assistance gave reassurances that the international community would do all that it could to help Japan.
So far, there are 62 search and rescue teams on standby, ready to be deployed should the Japanese government need their assistance. Japan told us they are, for the moment, assessing the situation and they have put their full forces into the response. So we need a request from them now. We need the green light.
Well, you can begin to get a sense of how strong this earthquake must have been from the accounts of those 400 kilometres from the epicentre in Tokyo. Among them, Chie Kobayashi, who was at home when the ground shook.
I was working at my desk in my apartment, and my apartment room is eighth floor, and I'm in the centre of Tokyo. Very close to Tokyo Tower. And when it happened, I thought it's similar to the medium-sized quake that we had a week ago. But it went larger and larger, and actually it was shaking everywhere. And I thought that my bookshelf might fall down. So I don't know why I was holding it. But lots of books came out from the shelf. And I went under the desk. That's what we are told when an earthquake happens. We should go under the desk to protect ourselves. So I did. And still, the whole desk was shaking. So I held the leg of the desk. And I was thinking, finally, the big quake is hitting Tokyo. We've been talking about this for years. And I thought, this is it. It finally came.
So were you very worried, or were you just actually going through the routine that you knew that you had to in order to try and protect yourself?
Yeah, I'm very happy that I think I was panicking, but I remember this routine thing. Maybe I did this only for the even for the smaller earthquake we have. I even do this, but it was the most scary experience in my life. I was pretty much worried. I was scared, and I would say I was panicked.
Did you have any sense how long the earthquake was going on for?
Yeah, it really felt like a long time. I was kind of praying, please stop now, please stop now. But it went, for me, I felt like it lasted for 10 minutes or something. I'm sure it was much, much shorter.
And was there much damage inside your apartment?
Actually, not much. Actually, lots of things, maybe almost everything, fell from the top of the shelf, bookshelf, and some CD, like all the CDs came down. And I also I was filling the water in my bathtub, and maybe 1/4 of the water came out from the bathtub. I also heard the sound of the water coming out. But the exterior of the apartment or any damage to the wall that I noticed.
You said that you knew immediately that you had to get cover, that you had to go under your desk, which you did do. Is there any point at which you are told or you instinctively feel that actually it's going to be safer for you to run out of your apartment and go out into the street?
Yes, since we are living in an earthquake country, we are all occasionally told that we should go underneath the desk when it happens. I think I was told at school and even in the office, we do a drill or simulation once a year or so. And so what we were told was just try to stay under the desk until it stops and not to try to jump out to the street right away.
For those of our listeners who thankfully have never experienced an earthquake, can you just give some sort of sense of what the movement is like? Because some people have compared it to be like being on a ship in a stormy sea. What does it feel like?
Yes, I'm sure. Yeah, it will be a very right description. I felt like first I thought that the very first moment I thought I'm feeling dizzy or something. Then I realized I'm standing on a wave or I'm in the ship in a very wild ocean or something.
That was Chie Kobayashi on the terror of enduring the earthquake in Tokyo. You're listening to the BBC World Service. It's 17:13 GMT. Now, one of the peculiar terrors of earthquakes are their apparent unpredictability. So are we getting any closer to understanding when and how they may strike? Dr. John Elliott is an earthquake geophysicist at Oxford University, and he's on the line now. Good afternoon to you, Dr. Elliott. Are we getting any better at being able to, well, to put it bluntly, predict when these earthquakes might strike?
Unfortunately, if you're asking about a prediction where we can give a time frame in which it's sensible to evacuate a population away from the danger, unfortunately, we are no nearer this despite decades of research. What we are trying to do, we're endeavouring to do more and more, is to assess areas of the region that are building up to these earthquakes where the large tectonic plates are shifting, trying to measure these areas and bring it home to the populations that there is potential for future rupture. But we certainly are nowhere near being able to give a prediction to say, next week you're going to need to evacuate this city for their safety.
And that's because, in layman's terms, even though you can see a build-up of tension under the ground, it's impossible to know when the major shift is going to happen, which is going to cause the earthquake.
Yes, I mean, an approximate everyday analogy would be if you were pulling an elastic band. The Earth's obviously more complicated than this, but simply if you're pulling your elastic band, it's quite hard for you to tell exactly when it's going to snap. You have that moment of fear as you're building up to it, but you don't actually know when it's going to break, and that's a similar situation we have with earthquakes. We can see it stretching, and the longer you wait, the more likely you think it is for these earthquakes to occur, but unfortunately you can't say it's going to happen tomorrow or next week.
And so in that sense, I mean, giving warnings to people that there is an increased likelihood of an earthquake isn't actually that much use because there's not much they can do with that information.
Well, that's not correct. Whilst they can't have a timely evacuation, the important thing that we're trying to convey are the regions of the globe that are prone to earthquakes. This is well known in Japan, and they build accordingly. The buildings up and down Japan, whilst there is massive devastation, have withstood quite well an absolutely massive earthquake, the fifth largest we've had in the last century. So knowing these regions that are prone to earthquakes, learning from past experience where there has been huge fatalities, as there was in Tokyo in 1923, when 140,000 lives were lost, lessons are learned from this. And if we can identify regions of the globe that are building up this pressure the most, then we can convey this scientific research to policymakers to try and push for stricter building codes and more reinforced buildings. Now, in a place like Japan, that's something that has been achieved. It's a fact of economics. It's possible to do there. There's the wealth and the willing. A lot of our research focuses on different parts of the developing world where this is much more difficult.
We always ask these questions when there's been more than one of these incidents in recent memory. And, of course, we've just had the earthquake in New Zealand. But is there any sort of pattern to these earthquakes? Is it possible to say that another one is more likely to happen? Or are these just simple coincidences?
I think in this case it's simple coincidence. I am actually currently researching the Christchurch earthquakes, and they were relatively small compared to this one and a long way away. So it's not that the Christchurch earthquakes have triggered this one in Japan. It is merely coincidence. There does seem to be a feeling that we hear more about these earthquakes in the news, and the death toll has been rising. And we can see that in patterns if we graph this over the last century. But that's not a factor of the tectonic plates shifting differently or faster. It's not that earthquakes are now more common. It's rather that our populations have grown and they've migrated to population centres, big urban cities, so that if this city lies underneath a fault, as in the case of Christchurch or places like Tokyo, then they now have a much bigger impact than they say did have 100 years ago.
Dr. Elliot from Oxford University, thank you very much. Well, the impact on people living near the quake's epicentre is, of course, foremost in everyone's minds. Damage to buildings, agriculture and business and industry is, though, also very extensive. Our business reporter Manuela Saragossa is here. And Manuela, are you able to assess yet what sort of effect this quake has had on industry in Japan?
Well, what we've been having all day is we've been getting updates all day from various big Japanese firms, and we've got a list pretty much compiled. Sony, for example, has halted production at 6 plants in the area. Toyota, 3 group factories have halted production. Nissan Motors is halting production at 4 plants. It's had 2 employees injured there. And Honda Motor as well, it halted production at 2 plants, had 1 employee who died in the quake and about 30 others who were injured. Now, all those plant closures have also translated to a drop in the world oil price. And that's because with plant closures, there's going to be less demand for energy in Japan, hence a drop in the oil price. There are also reports about nuclear plants. There are no reports of radioactive leaks at any of Japan's nuclear plants. So a fire at one was extinguished earlier in the day, and the government ordered thousands of residents near another nuclear plant outside Tokyo to move back at least 3 kilometres from that plant, and for others beyond that to stay indoors. Engineers there are trying to fix a malfunction in the reactor cooling mechanism. And in the last few moments, we've had a report in from Reuters quoting a local news agency saying that the pressure in that particular plant is rising and that they're trying to deal with that. Well, it's very little in terms of official information coming through in terms of what's happening to those nuclear plants. Now, the quake, in terms of the stock market, the quake hit just before the Japanese stock market was about to close. So the full impact hasn't been felt yet by the stock market. But the traders we were speaking to today say they expect that impact to be felt on Monday. No one will have forgotten that in the aftermath of the Kobe earthquake in 1995, the Tokyo share market did really badly for about 6 months after that. And that's at a time when the rest of the world's stock markets were doing well.
And what about transport links in Japan?
Well, there is no transport at all in Tokyo at the moment, nothing. Lots of commuters are stranded in the capital, and that's made worse by the fact that mobile phone networks have been shut down and landline services are severely disrupted. And the last reports I saw said that some outbound flights have resumed from Narita, Tokyo's main airport, but shippers are reporting that all Japanese ports are closed and that discharging operations, so unloading, has halted.
So this is going to affect the economy in the short term, but in the long term, when it comes to the cleanup operation, can Japan afford it?
We're cutting away from the BBC now so that we can join National Public Radio for their coverage of a press conference scheduled to begin at 11:30 our time at the White House. It is now 20 minutes past 11. This is Illinois Public Media, WYLL 580 AM, 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana.
This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, where in a few minutes, President Obama holds a news conference. Earlier, the White House advised us the president would open with a statement on gasoline prices. That, however, was before news of the devastating earthquake in Japan that triggered tsunami warnings across the Pacific. The president can't expect questions about any plans to release oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to stem rising energy prices. Gas is up over $3.50 a gallon on average. The civil war in Libya will also be on the agenda. Some critics say President Obama needs to act as Muammar Gaddafi's forces take the initiative against poorly armed rebels who've stepped up appeals for military help. The president has also been criticized for lack of leadership on the budget standoff in Congress. He may also get questions about Wisconsin, where Governor Scott Walker today signed a bill that eliminates most collective bargaining rights for public employees. Similar measures are under consideration in other states. With us here in studio are NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman, NPR economics correspondent John Itzi, and we begin with a Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. Tom, nice to have you with us today.
Neil, good to be here.
And the Navy has almost 40,000 military personnel in Japan, obviously most of them Navy, but others as well. Anything the U.S. military can do to assist in Japan?
Well, Neil, the Navy is sending about half dozen ships toward Japan. One of them is actually based in Japan. USS Tortuga, which took part in the helping Katrina victims. And they're going to be moving supplies ashore. We also have the carrier USS Ronald Reagan now in the South China Sea, about one day steaming time to Japan. And then also you have a huge number of Marines in Okinawa. They could be pressed into service if needed for humanitarian assistance, medical aid, and so forth.
And so the Ronald Reagan would have plenty of aircraft, helicopters, that sort of
Absolutely.
Thing to aid in those kinds of operations. Michelle Kellerman, what about the U.S. Embassy in Japan and any reports of casualties to U.S. citizens?
No, the State Department said today that there are no reports of deaths or injuries to American citizens that they know about now, and they've moved diplomats to a different location as a precaution. They've been warning Americans to avoid travel, avoid to Japan, saying that there's a big concern about aftershocks.
We've mentioned the tsunami warnings. The waves came ashore in Hawaii, did relatively little damage. No reports of casualties there. No reports of anything like that so far on the U.S. West Coast, and we'll obviously keep monitoring that. But John Itzi, we mentioned oil prices earlier. Well, the prices of oil on the international markets plummeted today.
They did. They plummeted because Japan has a huge economy, and it's going to be not doing very much for at least a short period of time. And since there really is no shortage of oil on the world market, prices went down. I think Japan is the second largest importer of oil in the world, so making that oil available to others means there's going to be plenty of oil around. What happens later, Japan will recover, obviously, and its economy will have to probably work even harder to rebuild, so it's not a long-term effect on the oil supply.
And speaking of that, Mara Liasson, the president, has been getting some pressure to open the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and at least drive down prices in the short term.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic. You know, this earthquake drove oil prices down. One of the reasons he's holding this press conference is because prices at the pump are going up. And, of course, he's being hammered by Republicans. This is a kind of age-old political exercise. If oil prices go up, whoever is the president gets to be criticized by the opposite party for somehow being responsible or not doing enough to fix it. But the situation in the Middle East, particularly Libya, which is a huge oil producer, has contributed to oil prices going up. What the president can do about it other than opening the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is unclear, and they have been considering it. I don't know if he's going to make an announcement about that today.
And Michelle Kellerman, as we turn to Libya, where the forces of Muammar Gaddafi have regained the initiative today and pushed back rebels on a couple of different fronts. Yesterday, France announced its official recognition of the rebels as the government of Libya, and there was a big meeting of the European Union today. And what's on the table? We know Secretary Clinton is heading to the region next week.
That's right. Well, the U.S. stopped short of that, but is Secretary Clinton said she will be meeting with opposition figures during this trip. She's going to be starting, actually, in France on Monday and then goes to Cairo and to Tunisia after that. So we're not sure exactly where she's going to be meeting the Libyans within that. But she did say she's reaching out to Libyan opposition groups. Their strategy so far has really been to build up international support for any sort of action against Libya. And the goal right now is to focus on humanitarian needs and also to isolate Gaddafi, to try to peel away any people who are close to Gaddafi and to keep the pressure up on him. Whether or not they're going to go further than that is still up in the air. She has a lot of negotiations to do with all these different regional groups, with the UN, et cetera.
Yesterday, Secretary of Defense Gates said NATO would only act if there is demonstrable need, a sound legal basis, and strong regional support. Tom Bowman, demonstrable need, that's presumably the situation on the ground?
Absolutely. And basically what he's saying is the killing hasn't reached a certain level where the international community has to go in and do something. It's not on the level of the Balkans, let's say in Srebrenica, where there was a massacre of 10,000 Muslim men and boys. They're still planning for a no-fly zone. That was a lot of the talk at the NATO meeting. Secretary Gates has said everybody has to understand a no-fly zone is not simple, very complex to get underway. The other thing is it's basically an act of war. Before you start a no-fly zone, you're going to be taking out their radar, taking out the Libyan missiles. You're going to war. And he's reminding everyone of that.
And sound legal basis, presumably that would be the Security Council of the United Nations, Michelle Kellerman.
Yeah, and the Security Council so far, they did approve a resolution that was very tough under Chapter 7, but it was specifically had to do with sanctions. It did not endorse military action. The British and the French, we're told, are working on a Security Council resolution that would pave the way for a no-fly zone. But again, this is all, you know, back burner right now. It's going on. They want to show Gaddafi that this planning is going on, but it hasn't moved to the stage where they're really considering any vote on that.
And strong regional support would be the Arab League, the African Union. Arab League meets on Saturday, I believe, in Cairo, and there would be looking for them to be calling for Western or United Nations support for a no-fly zone for military action. And Mara Liasson, again, the president has been getting some criticism from Republicans for acting too cautiously here.
He's been getting criticism for not leading. It's not just Republicans. He's really been hammered by the editorial pages of the New York Times and the Washington Post for setting up a situation where he says all the options are on the table, but every day they try to explain why one or another option can't be taken. He's been accused of putting himself in a straitjacket, of sending conflicting messages to Gaddafi, or setting up a situation where Gaddafi only has the option of kind of fighting to the death here because he has no other option. He'll go before the world court if he ever is removed from Libya. This is a very tough problem for the White House. They're very frustrated by the criticism. They say that they are acting with unbelievable speed, much faster than any other international community with American leadership has acted in a situation like this. It's complicated. They don't know who these rebels are. They don't know if they're like the Mujahideen who morphed into the Taliban. Very unclear. One thing that they have decided to do is have the president keep a low profile and not put in any way, shape, or form an American stamp on this enterprise.
You know, what they want to all do is work together. There's going to be a beefed up humanitarian assistance, we believe, having the Navy ships steaming that way, helping out with humanitarian, getting food ashore, and also moving refugees maybe from Tunisia back to Egypt. But as far as doing anything more militarily, that could be some time.
And we're talking with NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. You just heard before that Mara Liasson, our national political correspondent, Michelle Kellerman, our diplomacy correspondent, also with us here in the studio, along with economics correspondent John Itzde. We're expecting the president to emerge in a few minutes at the old executive office building's South Court Auditorium to hold a news conference. This was initially scheduled earlier today, postponed. We know the president made a call to the prime minister of Japan to offer American assistance in the terrible crisis there after the 8.9 earthquake in the northeastern part of that country earlier today, and presumably waiting to get the latest information on that. In the meantime, Mara Liasson, the president being criticized for lack of leadership, you mentioned in Libya's situation, but also on the budget situation as well.
Yes, I mean, he can't get any break here, but the budget negotiations have not produced a compromise. Next Friday is the day that the last temporary spending measure runs out, so there could be a government shutdown. And Democrats, who haven't been able to unify on a single proposal of their own, have been complaining, as they have done in the past in this situation, that he isn't telling them exactly what he wants. But the White House says talks are underway. Vice President Biden called House Speaker John Boehner by phone from Russia to talk about the budget. And but at some point, the president himself is going to have to sit down with the Republican leaders and hash this out.
And that remains to be seen. We're expecting the president to come out in just about a minute. John Itzty, remind us the situation with the gas prices, the thing the president wanted to talk about initially.
Yeah, gas prices are now above $3.50 a gallon, a very high level for Americans.
Especially this time of the year.
Especially this time of the year. They usually go up more in the summertime during the summer driving season. The Federal Reserve basically says any $10 increase in the price of oil per barrel reduces 2 percentage points of GDP and raises gas prices about 25 cents a gallon. So another $10 increase in the price of oil, another 25 or per barrel, another 25-cent increase in a gallon of gas. There's also evidence that if oil hits a round number like $4 a gallon, gas hits a round number like $4 a gallon, people change sharply their spending behavior. And so that could be a real hit to the economy.
We've seen recently consumer spending increase a full percentage point last month. We saw those figures earlier. And unemployment has come down a bit, the economic recovery seeming to pick up speed, but that could certainly
be
threatened.
It's still fragile. Yeah, it's certainly still fragile and subject to shocks. Another big hike in oil prices, already up $20 a barrel.
And the president is now coming out on the auditorium at Executive Office Building.
Before I begin, I want to say a few words about the terrible earthquake and tsunami that struck Japan earlier today. First and foremost, our thoughts and our prayers are with the people of Japan. This is a potentially catastrophic disaster, and the images of destruction and flooding coming out of Japan are simply heartbreaking. Japan is, of course, one of our strongest and closest allies. And this morning I spoke with Prime Minister Kan. On behalf of the American people, I conveyed our deepest condolences, especially the victims and their families, and I offered our Japanese friends whatever assistance is needed. We currently have an aircraft carrier in Japan, and another is on its way. We also have a ship en route to the Marianas Islands to assist as needed. The Defense Department is working to account for all our military personnel in Japan. U.S. Embassy personnel in Tokyo have moved to an off-site location, and the State Department is working to account for and assist any and all American citizens who are in the country. Tsunami warnings have been issued across the Pacific, and we've already seen initial waves from the tsunami come ashore on Guam and other U.S. territories in Alaska and Hawaii, as well as on along the West Coast. Here in the United States, there hasn't been any major damage so far, but we're taking this very seriously, and we are monitoring the situation very closely. FEMA is fully activated and is coordinating with state and local officials to support these regions as necessary. And let me just stress that if people are told to evacuate, do as you are told. Today's events remind us of just how fragile life can be. Our hearts go out to our friends in Japan and across the region, and we're going to stand with them as they recover and rebuild from this tragedy. Now, before I take a few questions, let me say a few words about something that's obviously been on the minds of many Americans here at home, and that's the price of gasoline. In an economy that relies on oil, gas prices affect everybody, from farmers and truck drivers to restaurant owners and workers, as well as consumers. Businesses see rising prices affect their bottom line. Families feel the pinch every time they fill up the tank. For Americans already facing tough times, it's an added burden. Of course, rising prices are not a new phenomenon. 3 years ago, before the recession hit, A combination of factors, including rising demand from emerging economies like China, drove gas prices to more than $4 a gallon. The worldwide recession and the decrease in demand pushed prices back down. But over the past year, as the economy's picked up steam and global demand for oil has increased, prices have increased again. Turmoil in North Africa and the Middle East has added uncertainty to the mix, and lost production in Libya has tightened supply. Now, here's the good news. The global community can manage supply disruptions like this. Other oil-producing nations have committed to filling any gaps, and we will continue to coordinate closely with our international partners to keep all options on the table when it comes to any supply disruptions. Here at home, everybody should know that should the situation demand it, we are prepared to tap the significant stockpile of oil that we have in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. We're also using the resources at our disposal at the federal level to monitor any possible manipulation in the oil markets. And I'm asking the Attorney General and relevant agencies to work with states' attorneys general to monitor for price gouging to make sure that nobody is taking advantage of working families at the pump. In addition, America is better prepared for supply disruptions than we used to be. Today, we use 7% less oil than we did in 2005, even as our economy has grown since then, partly because our economy as a whole is more efficient. We're adapting. We're producing more oil, and we're importing less. Our automakers, for example, are manufacturing more fuel-efficient cars, some that now get more than 50 miles to the gallon. And our consumers are driving more of these cars. In December, Democrats and Republicans came together to pass a payroll tax cut that is already helping to grow our economy and create jobs. In the wake of rising gas prices, it should also help act as a cushion for working families. This doesn't lessen our commitment to do everything that we can to get gas prices down, but that tax cut will total about $1,000 for the average working family this year, or an extra $80 or so showing up in your paycheck each month. And that tax relief package is a key reason that even with these higher prices, economists and investors like Warren Buffett believe we should still expect solid growth and strong private sector job creation this year. Now, the hard truth is that as long as our economy depends on foreign oil, we'll always be subject to price spikes. So we've got to get moving on a comprehensive energy strategy that pursues both more energy production and more energy conservation. We need to increase our access to secure energy supplies in the near term, and we've got to make our economy more energy efficient and energy independent over the long run. So let me be more specific. First, we need to continue to boost domestic production of oil and gas. Last year, American oil production reached its highest level since 2003. Let me repeat that. Our oil production reached its highest level in 7 years. Oil production from federal waters in the Gulf of Mexico reached an all-time high. For the first time in more than a decade, imports accounted for less than half of what we consumed. So any notion that my administration has shut down oil production might make for a good political soundbite, but it doesn't match up with reality. We are encouraging offshore exploration and production. We're just doing it responsibly. I don't think anybody's forgotten that we're only a few months removed from the worst oil spill in our history. So what we've done is to put in place common sense standards, like proving that companies can actually contain an underwater spill. And oil companies are stepping up. We've approved more than 35 new offshore drilling permits that meet these new safety and environmental standards. There is more we can do, however. For example, right now, the industry holds leases on tens of millions of acres, both offshore and on land, where they aren't producing a thing. So I've directed the Interior Department to determine just how many of these leases are going undeveloped and report back to me within 2 weeks so that we can encourage companies to develop the leases they hold and produce American energy. People deserve to know that the energy they depend on is being developed in a timely manner. We're also taking steps that will enable us to gather data on potential gas and oil resources off the Mid and South Atlantic. And we're working with industry to explore new frontiers of production, safety measures, and containment technology. We're looking at potential new development in Alaska, both onshore and offshore. And when it comes to imported oil, we're strengthening our key energy relationships with other producer nations, something that I will discuss with President Rousseff when I visit Brazil next week. All these actions can increase domestic oil production in the short and medium term. But let's be clear, it is not a long-term solution. Even if we started drilling new wells tomorrow, that oil isn't coming online overnight. And even if we tap every single reserve available to us, we can't escape the fact that we only control 2% of the world's oil, but we consume over a quarter of the world's oil. T. Boone Pickens, who made his fortune in the oil business, and I don't think anybody would consider him unfriendly to drilling, was right when he said that this is one emergency we can't drill our way out of. We can't place our long-term bets on a finite resources that we only control 2% of, especially resources that's vulnerable to hurricanes, war, and political turmoil. So beyond increased domestic production, if we want to secure our long-term prosperity and protect the American people from more severe oil shocks in the future, the way to do it is to gradually reduce demand and then do everything we can to break our dependence on oil. For example, last year we established a groundbreaking national fuel efficiency standard for cars and trucks. It's going to save consumers money while conserving about 1.8 billion barrels of oil. And we're working with automakers, auto workers, and states to ensure that the high-quality, fuel-efficient cars and trucks of tomorrow continue to be built right here in the United States of America. To satisfy our broader energy needs, we're working to diversify our entire portfolio with historic investments in clean energy. Right now, all across America, our farmers are producing homegrown fuels, our scientists are looking for the next breakthroughs, and our workers are back in once-shuttered factories, manufacturing wind turbines and solar panels and advanced batteries that will help our cars get hundreds of miles to the gallon. These are jobs that didn't exist 2 years ago, and we want to create millions more of these jobs. And in this year's State of the Union address, I set a goal for America. By 2035, 80% of our electricity will come from a broad array of clean energy sources, from renewables like wind and solar and homegrown biofuels, along with natural gas, clean coal, and nuclear power. So these are just some of the steps that we've already taken to secure America's energy future. And over the course of the weeks and months ahead, we will take more. But the bottom line is this. We've been having this conversation for nearly four decades now. Every few years, gas prices go up, politicians pull out the same old political playbook, and then nothing changes. And when prices go back down, we slip back into a trance, and then when prices go up, suddenly we're shocked. I think the American people are tired of that. I think they're tired of talk. And we've got to work together, Democrats, Republicans, and everybody in between, to finally secure America's energy future. I don't want to leave this for the next president, and none of us should want to leave it for our kids. So with that, let me take a few questions, and I'm going to start with Mr. Todd.
Thank you, Mr. President. I want to start with Libya. You had said that you want to see Gaddafi leave power, mm-hmm. leave office. Are you prepared to use any means necessary in the United States government to make that happen? And if not, why not? I know in the cases of some of these other uprisings, there's been a careful consideration not to take sides, let the people in those countries make this decision. But in this case, it does seem we have taken sides.
Yeah.
So what's the red line?
Well, first of all, let's take a look at what we've already done. My first priority, obviously, was getting out American citizens and embassy personnel out of Libya, and we got that done. The very next day, we had already instituted the largest financial seizure of assets in our history. And the day after that, we had imposed sanctions and we had mobilized the international community through the United Nations so that across the board, we are slowly tightening the noose on Gaddafi. He is more and more isolated internationally, both through sanctions as well as an arms embargo. In addition to that, we've provided a host of humanitarian aid measures to make sure that people are not adversely affected as they cross the borders into Tunisia or Egypt, and we will continue to do that. And what we've done is we've organized in NATO a series of conversations about a wide range of options that we can take. Everything from 24-hour surveillance so that we can monitor the situation on the ground and react rapidly if conditions deteriorated, to further efforts with respect to an arms embargo, additional efforts on humanitarian aid, but also potential military options, including a no-fly zone. NATO will be meeting on Tuesday to consider a no-fly zone, and we've been in discussions with both Arab countries as well as African countries to gauge their support for such an action. In addition, Secretary Hillary Clinton will be meeting with the opposition in the next several days, and we have determined that it's appropriate for us to assign a representative whose specific job is to interact with the opposition and determine ways that we can further help them. And so we're going to be in close consultation with them. So the bottom line is that I have not taken any options off the table at this point. I think it is important to understand that we have moved about as swiftly as an international coalition has ever moved to impose sanctions on Gaddafi. I am absolutely clear that it is in the interest of the United States and, more importantly, in the interest of the Libyan people for Mr. Gaddafi to leave. And I have not foreclosed these options. Now, I do take very seriously making sure that any decisions I make that involve U.S. military power are well thought through and are done in close consultation with Secretary Gates, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen, and all relevant personnel. You know, anytime I send United States forces into a potentially hostile situation, there are risks involved and there are consequences. And it is my job as President to make sure that we have considered all those risks. It's also important from a political perspective to, as much as possible, maintain the strong international coalition that we have right now.
Are you concerned that he feel that because you've called for his removal, you've imposed all these sanctions, that Gaddafi feels cornered, has no other option in his mind but to just keep fighting, and in the words of your Director of National Intelligence, he may have the firepower to potentially win this standoff with the rebels?
I am concerned, absolutely. And I think that's why it's so important for us not to stop where we are, but to continue to find options that will add additional pressure, including sending a clear message to those around Gaddafi that the world is watching and we're paying attention and that there have been referrals to the International Criminal Court. Part of what we're going to be wanting to do is to change the balance, not just militarily inside of Libya, but also to change the balance in terms of those who are around Gaddafi and are thinking about what their future prospects are if they continue down the course that they're on. But Chuck, there's no doubt that I am concerned about it. Gaddafi has a stash of weapons. He not only has some troops that remain loyal to him, but there have been reports that he's also been hiring mercenaries. Even with the financial freeze that we've imposed, he still has some assets. The rebel groups are just now getting organized. And so we're going to have to continue to apply pressure. And that's why I say we have not taken any options off the table at this point. Mimi Hall.
Thank you, Mr. President. Just to follow up on Libya, and I also have a budget question. Mm-hmm. You say you're concerned, but is Gaddafi staying, is that an acceptable option for you ever? And my question on the budget is, there's been some criticism from members of your own party about your leadership on negotiations, on spending. And I'm wondering, given that, if you can talk about where you stand on a three-week CR, mm-hmm. on longer-term priorities, and what you would and would not accept on, sure. On cuts. Thank you.
Going back to the Gaddafi question, as I said before, it is in the United States' interest and the interest of the people of Libya that Gaddafi leave. And we are going to do we're going to take a wide range of actions to try to bring about that outcome. You know, when you say, is it ever acceptable? I mean, I think what you're asking is, you know, are we going to engage in any potential military action to make that happen? And as I said before, when it comes to U.S. military actions, whether it's a no-fly zone or other options, you've got to balance costs versus benefits. And, you know, I don't take those decisions lightly. But let me be as clear as I can about the desired outcome from our perspective, and that is that Gaddafi stepped down. And we are going to continue to work with the international community to try to achieve that. And we are going to be in close consultation with these opposition groups as they get organized to see how we can bring about that outcome. Now, with respect to the budget, I think it's important to understand that right now the discussion is about last year's business. We're talking about how to fund the remainder of this fiscal year. This is an appropriations task, and we have been in very close contact with all members of Congress, both parties. I've had conversations with Mr. McConnell. I've had conversations with Mr. Boehner, I've had conversations with Nancy Pelosi, and I've had conversations with Harry Reid about how they should approach this budget problem. Here's what we know. The Republicans in the House passed a budget that has been now rejected in the Senate. They are not going to get 100% of what they want. The Democrats have put forward spending cuts, many of them pretty painful, that give Republicans already half of what they were seeking, because they're the right thing to do. Many of those cuts are ones that were already embodied in the budget that I proposed for 2012. Now, that's been rejected as well. So here's what we know, that both sides are going to have to sit down and compromise on prudent cuts somewhere between what the Republicans were seeking that's now been rejected and what the Democrats had agreed to that has also been rejected. It shouldn't be that complicated. And so what I've done is every day I talk to my team, I give them instructions in terms of how they can participate in the negotiations, indicate what's acceptable, indicate what's not acceptable, and our expectation is that we should be able to get this completed. Now, because I think neither Democrats or Republicans were in the mood to compromise until their 100% maximal position was voted down in the Senate, we've probably lost some time. And we may not be able to fully resolve this and meet next week's deadline for the continuing resolution, which means that there may be potentially one more short-term extension. But let me just make some broad points about this. Number one, we can't keep on running the government based on two-week extensions. That's irresponsible. I mean, we've got a war in Afghanistan going on. We've got a wide range of issues facing the country on a day-to-day basis. And the notion that we can't get resolved last year's budget in a sensible way with serious but prudent spending cuts, I think, defies common sense. So we should be able to get it done. Point number two, there are going to be certain things that House Republicans want that I will not accept. And the reason I won't accept them is not because I don't think we've got to cut the budget. We do. And we've already put forward significant cuts in the discretionary budget, some of which have not made members of my own party happy. But the notion that we would cut, for example, Pell Grants, when we know the single most important thing to our success as a nation long term is how well educated our kids are. And the proposal that was coming out of the House would cut this year about $800 out of Pell Grants for 8 million kids, and if we're extended into next year, would cut in half the Pell Grants that they're receiving. That makes no sense. The notion that we would decide that under the Republican budget proposal to eliminate 200,000 Head Start slots, that also would mean the layoffs of 55,000 teachers. That doesn't make sense. The principle that I've tried to put forward since the State of the Union is we've got to live within our means. We've got to get serious about managing our budget. But we can't stop investing in our people. We can't stop investing in research and development. We can't stop investing in infrastructure, those things that are going to make us competitive over the long term and will help us win the future. And so I've communicated directly to Speaker Boehner, as well as to Republican Leader McConnell, that we want to work with them to get to a sustainable discretionary budget. And we think it is important for us to stop funding programs that don't work. But we're going to make sure that we hold the line when it comes to some critical programs that are either going to help us out-educate, out-innovate, or out-build other countries. Last point I'll make on the budget. The Republican budget that passed out of the House included a whole range of what are called riders. These aren't really budget items. These are political statements. And I want, I've said again directly to Speaker Boehner that we're happy to discuss any of these riders, but my general view is let's not try to sneak political agendas into a budget debate. You know, if Republicans are interested in social issues that they want to promote, they should put a bill on the floor of the House and promote it. Have an up or down vote. Send it over to the Senate. But don't try to use the budget as a way to promote a political or ideological agenda. I think that's the American people's view as well. You know, I think one of the messages that the American people have clearly sent is get serious about living within our means and managing our budget in a responsible way, and stop with the political bickering. And if we have that view in mind, then I think that not only can we get this short-term issue resolved, but I think we can actually solve the long-term budget issues as well. Jake Tapper. Where's Jake?
Thanks, Mr. President. Yeah. Experts say they can't recall a time when the U.S. ever had to rush assistance to a nuclear power plant in another country before. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about how serious this is with the U.S. rushing coolant to Japan because of the nuclear plant there? And then a second question. The State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley said the treatment of Bradley Manning by the Pentagon is ridiculous and counterproductive and stupid. And I'm wondering if you agree with that. Thank you, sir.
On point number one, when I spoke to Prime Minister Khan, I specifically asked him about the nuclear plants and their potential vulnerability as a consequence of the earthquake. He indicated that they are monitoring the situation very closely. So far, they have not seen evidence of radiation leaks. But obviously, you've got to take all potential precautions. I've asked Steve Chu, our Energy Secretary, to be in close contact with their personnel to provide any assistance that's necessary, but also to make sure that if, in fact, there have been breaches in the safety system on these nuclear plants, that they're dealt with right away. With respect to Private Manning, you know, I have actually asked the Pentagon whether or not the procedures that have been taken in terms of his confinement are appropriate and are meeting our basic standards. They assure me that they are. I can't go into details about some of their concerns, but some of this has to do with Private Manning's safety as well. I think I gave you an answer to the substantive issue.
Can you give one quick question? How did that happen? Why?
I don't yet have all the details, Jake, so I'm going to have to defer that question until we get more. Obviously, the tragedy just happened a few hours ago, and there's going to be a lot of fact-finding that we're going to have to determine. Chip Reed.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'd like to go at the